Christian Parenting.
This is Be Love, Do Good Podcast, and I'm your host, Christy Hayes, mama to two, founder of Be Strong Story, and author of the children's book, The Lunchbox Note, a true story of how a lunchbox note that said, be strong, protect the weak, love everyone, changed our life, and created a mission for our family. Join us each week for conversations that inspire our families to live out true compassion, kindness, and what it looks like to be love and do good in our communities. It may take us out of our comfort zones, you guys, but I promise it will put us on a path to see others, love others, and quite possibly change the world. Hey everyone, thanks for joining me today on Be Love, Do Good Podcast. I'm so excited for our guest, Kurt Thompson. He is a psychologist, he's an author, a very well-known author and speaker, and I can't wait for him to dive into his new book, The Deepest Place. We talk about embracing suffering. Who wants to embrace that, right? He talks about building a relationship with suffering, how we can do it in community, how we can help our kids embrace suffering at a young age so they know how to handle it when they get older. It is chocked full of some incredible nuggets of wisdom, and it's a little bit longer than my normal podcast, but I encourage you to stick with it. It will be something that just refreshes your soul, gives you some hope. And for those of you who want to get to the part about the parenting, if you go to minute 35, you'll start hearing a little bit more about that. So please welcome Kurt Thompson to the podcast. Hey, Kurt, thanks so much for being on Be Love, Do Good Podcast. I am so fortunate and honored to have you on. I know a lot of your work, and we're so grateful for you to be talking about just emotions, some of those hard things that we aren't used to talking about or we don't want to talk about. So thanks for leading us through a conversation today.
Well, Christy, thanks so much for having me. It's an honor and a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you. So I'm just going to dig in because honestly, I know a lot of friends who are dealing with this topic, and it's a really hard topic to talk about. It's not something that you just think, oh, let's talk about this. So we're going to talk about suffering today. Suffering is not something that many of us enjoy. We don't welcome it in any way. And in your new book, you talk about, in the Deepest Place, your new book, you talk about suffering and why it's so important and how you can welcome it. And so let's just start off with that. Let's talk a little bit about your definition of suffering and just how do we learn to talk about that when that is something that we really don't want to talk about?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think a couple things. One is, you know, framing this conversation from the perspective of the biblical narrative, the notion that how do we, as Jesus followers, approach and posture ourselves toward this is significant as a beginning place, because the Christian story is the only story that we have in the world that actually honors suffering. And by that, we don't mean that it you know, tells a message that suffering is a good thing, but what I mean by that is that, you know, what we tend to think about suffering in the West is like, we'll do everything we can to get rid of it. We'll do everything we can to cure it, but we still see it as a bad thing. That is a sign that something's not right. And we only see it as that. And in Eastern philosophy, Eastern ways of seeing things is a posture that has us actually just kind of pretending that suffering isn't there. We're going to mindfully imagine that suffering is just something that our mind is making up. But neither the East or the West have ways of looking at suffering square in the face and saying something really good is going to come out of this. And the biblical narrative says to us in Jesus that God is going to wade right into our suffering with us where we are and not leave us alone with it. And in so doing, give us the opportunity for suffering to actually transform us. Again, not saying that suffering is a good thing itself, but that we can be transformed by it. And also doing so in such a way that our impression of suffering is also transformed, which we may talk about. We in clinical terms, and this the suffering is not just something that the Bible defines. A couple of things also to know about it. Number one, to suffer is to be human. Anyone who's in our listening audience either is suffering or knows someone who is or who has, and we may not all be suffering in the same way right now, perhaps as we even suffered in the past or that we may suffer in the future, but in some way, shape, or form, at some point, suffering is a thing that is going to touch every single one of our lives. We like to talk about suffering being our experience of pain. Like we have things that happen to us that are painful, whether those are physical things, medical things, or whether those are emotional and psychological things. It's a painful experience that we experience over time. And so suffering is a way that we talk about and measure our response to pain over time. If I have something that's painful that hits me in the moment and then it's gone 5 minutes later, I don't really talk much about suffering, even if the pain was really bad. But if I have a paper cut that bothers me for 10 days, there can be elements of that, that, you know, it feels like I'm suffering because there's a certain sense in which that suffering is a function of how I am responding to the pain over a period of time. We also like to say that, you know, it's important to remember that, we have a tendency to compare our suffering to other people's suffering. And we can say, well, my suffering, like, because my suffering isn't the suffering of Joe or Sarah, it's not nearly that bad. Therefore, my suffering isn't really suffering. And so I don't pay attention to it. Or we do just the opposite. We can say, no one understands my suffering. My suffering is worse than anyone's. And in both cases, what we do is that we give suffering a place that it doesn't deserve. But also in both cases, we are doing what the Christian story, what the gospel points out, is not the case for us and God in the way the Bible talks about suffering, which is that God has the intention of being with us in the middle of it. Which is why when in the deepest place we explore the first five verses of the fifth chapter of Romans, when Paul talks about suffering leading to perseverance, leading to character, leading to hope, that passage does not begin with suffering. It begins with something else. And so as Christians, we don't begin to talk about suffering by beginning with suffering. We begin with other things, which is why it's crucially important for us to be aware of those other things that are in play for us when we talk about how we are responding to our pain over time.
Talk to me a little bit in the book, one of the quotes that you talk about that I love so much, and I've seen it even in my own life, is you talk about if we are securely attached to Jesus, then ultimately we live in a safe world. And when I read that, it's interesting, my kind of affirmation, mantra, whatever you want to call it, for this year that I write, that I wrote on my mirror, that I say every day, is basically that I can let go, that I don't have to be worried today or fearful for what happens, that as long as I'm with him, I'm safe, I'm secure. And I say it over and over again. So talk to me a little bit about what you meant by that.
One of the models that is helpful for us in imagining our relationship with God, and this is a model, this is not to suggest that this is the defining model, that it's the best or the only model for this. But given that we have been made in God's image, we've been made to function the way that God functions, we are aware that the process of attachment is a relational process that involves the brain that is involved in everything that we do as human beings. If you're a child that grows up and develops a secure attachment with your parents in your home, one might say that you are safe in your home. But that doesn't keep that child from running through the kitchen in his stocking feet, slipping, cutting his eye open on the kitchen counter. And then we ask the question, well, is the house safe or not? Is he safe or not? And we might say, well, I'm not quite so sure because he cut his eye open and so forth and so on. And yet we would say, of course he's ultimately safe. It's also true that to be safe in the way that we are talking about does not mean that we never get hurt, does not mean that we never experience painful emotion does not mean that we don't experience heartache or brokenness or that we never suffer. It does not mean this. To be safe in this way is to mean that we are comfortable and confident in our skin, in our relationship with someone else who so captivates our attention that our attention is more drawn to that than it is drawn to the things about my life that are creating my pain. In this way, when our boy falls and cuts his eye, someone comes to him and we either patch it up or we take him to the urgent care and we get that fixed up in such a way that he's learning that even in a world where things are not perfect, we look outside in our world, yeah, it's a hard place to live. But when you read the first chapter and second chapter of Ephesians, especially the end of the first chapter, where we read Paul's language about all things being drawn up into Jesus, who is over all things, that makes a difference for us. But what's really crucial here, Christy, I think, is that it's not enough to simply tell people that they're safe. It's not enough to simply tell people, you live in a safe world, don't worry about it, you'll be fine. The human brain is primed to look for danger. It's primed to expect and anticipate painful, hard things in the world. I pay attention to those things because I'm trying to stay alive. And so I spend a lot of time in my mind imagining that the world is not safe. And then I live as if it's not safe. I live anxiously because there are so many things that are happening in which I am being formed to believe that I live in a dangerous world. And so the real question is not just, well, do I believe or do I not believe that I live in an ultimately safe world? The real question is, what am I doing on a regular daily basis that is forming me to pay attention to the presence of God, a God in the person of Jesus and the body of Jesus that is in this world in a material way? What am I doing to allow that to encode itself in my brain and in my body such that I don't believe that I live in a safe world because I just read that in the Bible or heard the pastor say that from the pulpit, but because I feel it in my chest? Because as we like to say, as far as the brain and the mind and the body are concerned, until I feel whatever it is in my chest, it's not yet ultimately real for me. And this is why practicing paying attention to these things in ways that allow them to be embodied for me is the way forward in terms of how we come to believe that we live in a safe world. That whole word believe, the English word believe, is the word to be living as if something in the world is true.
That's great. So walk me through, if I am, our listeners are in a space of suffering, because we all will feel that at some point, whether we're in it right now. How do we get to a place that we are welcoming it, that we are looking past our suffering to Jesus, to that eternal perspective? Because I'm going to guarantee that just listening to this podcast, listening to you say it, listening, reading it in your book, it's not automatically like, oh, awesome, I don't want to avoid suffering anymore. I can't wait to welcome it in my life. What are some tangible ways you know, people who are listening probably like, well, that sounds great, but I'm in like the depths of pain. I remember a couple years ago when I was in like the deepest, darkest that I've ever been. And I just have never experienced, I mean, I've lived a life of very pretty easy and had never experienced it. And it was one of those places where I thought, I will never be happy again. I will never be the bubbly, joyful Christy that everybody knows. I just won't. I will never. That's how bad it felt. You know, it just felt like that. And so if you would have said to me, well, welcome it, you know, don't avoid it, it'll be fine, I would be like, that's good for someone else, but it's not going to work for me. So talk to me how you walk through people through this, don't avoid it anymore, welcome it, and here are the steps to kind of to help you do that.
Well, I think, like I mentioned before, in Paul's words that we read in the fifth chapter of Romans, he doesn't just launch into the topic of suffering. He approaches suffering with some really important steps that come before that. In this passage in Romans 5, 1 through 5, he starts with, therefore, since we have been justified through faith. And when we look at those words, justification and faith, it's easy for us to first think that, well, they're just primarily theological ideas. But the whole notion of faith is the question of trust, and not just trust in an idea, but genuinely experienced, embodied awareness that I am trusting the person of Jesus. This is not just an assent to a set of religious beliefs. This is the question of, do I have an experience with Jesus such that I am able, in my imagination, to sense his presence in the room? And who are the people that are in that are his representatives by whom I am having this experience lived out? This is the way the gospel works. It doesn't work magically. It works through real time and space in real human beings, passing this on to other human beings through the power of the Holy Spirit. And so the first question is, who are the people by whom you're being deeply known such that in your suffering, they have access to you. They have access to your experience. Who are the people by whom you are being so deeply connected and known that there's nothing about your suffering experience that they do not know? That's the first question. Mm-hmm. Paul then moves on to this notion of our having peace with God. And we could talk at length. We talk about this in the book, this notion that we in the West don't have much of a sense of what it means to be at war with God. We've heard the gospel. We know we have peace with God. We just kind of assume that, accept that. The challenge is that there are parts of me that still believe I am at war with God. The people to whom Paul was writing, they were very familiar with the notion that the gods are always at war with us. And the evidence of this is that I don't have enough to eat. The evidence of this is that my wife is barren. The evidence of this is that as a slave, I'm being mistreated by my Roman slaveholder. All the things that we hear, they would suggest that this is all about the gods capriciously being angry with us, doing with us what they want. And Paul comes along and says, actually, because of Jesus, you're at peace. That would have real-time implications for people. For us, less so. Until we start to honestly pull the curtain back on parts of my story that still live as if, just like Adam in Adam and Eve, I believe that God is coming to kill me. Right? Adam hid because he'd been told that on the day that you eat the fruit, you're going to die. And there have all, I mean, our, in our listeners, I'm sure that there are, you know, many of us have parts of us that believe that we are at war with God. And I'm not able to step into or approach or begin to talk about suffering until I'm actually able to acknowledge that there are parts of me that believe there are war with God, and I won't let them come into the room because I know what God's going to do when they get here. And if they're not addressed, the whole notion of suffering is not going to be addressed.
Give me some of those things that we would be at war with God about. Like, give me some examples.
Well, I would say, here's one example. It's probably been now about 2 or 3 years ago that in the course of my own life, it became clear to me that there is a part of me that believes God's a tyrant. Mm. There's a part of me that believes that there are certain things that I want in life and I'm not going to get them. I want them. Certain things that I'm worried about between now and the time that I die, if they don't happen, I'm going to get to heaven and God is just going to say, shame on you for even wanting that. There's a part of my story that developed in my first, you know, 2 decades of development that transferred my experiences growing up in my house onto God without knowing that that's what I'm doing, and have, since I've been a kid, lived believing that God is a tyrant. Mm-hmm. And so that filters, that shapes all kinds of things that I experience and translate in relationally with other people. Translates into how much risk I'm willing to take. Because ultimately, that part does not believe that I'm in a safe mm-hmm. world. That part believes that I'm in a world that at the end of the day, God's going to get whatever he wants, and I may or may not get what I want, but probably not. How many of us have had experiences of unfinished, unhealed trauma? that if you were to ask those parts of us, so what do you think about God? We might say, if he exists at all, I certainly don't believe he cares about me. And if he does exist, maybe he doesn't just not care about me, maybe he's out to get me. Now, it's possible that not all of me would believe that, but there will be parts of me, just like the father in Mark chapter 9, who at the end of Jesus healing his son, and Jesus said, if anything with God is possible, he said, I believe, help thou my unbelief. I have parts of me that don't believe, parts of me that still believe that I'm at war with God. And then moving on to Paul's language of glory, parts of me that don't really comprehend that one of the ways to understand what Paul's talking about God's glory, is the same kind of glory that we hear mostly about in John's gospel. This notion that the glory of God, the glory of Jesus, we beheld his glory. This is John chapter 1. The glory of a father and a son. This notion that this glory is not just about God's grandeur, God's beauty, God's awesomeness. This is the kind of glory that we experience when God walks into the room and says, Christy, oh my gosh, I can't believe I get to be here with you. And you're looking around for some other Christy, like which Christy are you talking to? And then God proceeds to take you around and introduce you to all of his best friends. Because it is his glory to lavish his delight upon you. Most of us are not walking around, waking up in the morning, thinking like, oh my gosh, the Trinity is in my bedroom and they can't wait for us to start the day together. To the degree that I am limited in my sense of God's glory, to the degree that I am still at war with God, to the degree that my attachment with God is insecurely formed, I will approach suffering only as something I need to get rid of because it's only painful and that's all I can see it to be. But now, in a context of a relationship with a Trinitarian God that gets manifested in his body, in the body of those with whom I have connection, I now have an experience such that when my pain continues and I enter into a space of suffering, no matter what that pain is about, relationally, psychologically, emotionally, physically, medically, I am simultaneously paying attention to those who are gathering around me and saying, no matter how hard the pain is, we're not leaving the room. We're not leaving the room. I am with you even to the end of the age. We're not leaving the room. When Jesus says to his followers, I have said in John's gospel, I have said these things to you so that in me you will have peace. In this world, you will have tribulation. He's acknowledging that suffering is a feature of being human. In this world, you will have tribulation. I've said these things to you, not so that you will have peace in some abstract ideology, in some theology, in some set of principles. You will have peace in me.
Yeah.
And we are extensions of Jesus, such that the presence of others, unlike Job's friends, do not necessarily show up and hang out so that we can tell you why it is that you need to correct your way so that you won't suffer, so that we won't be anxious.
Right, right. Our suffering is affecting is affecting them. When we heard that, I think Jenny Allen might have written it, about going through their life together. So basically they walked through when they were younger and, you know, all their years. So I took our Bible study actually did this, and I asked them, can we do this? We actually did it for probably, it almost took a year for five women to go through each of their whole life. And we would do, you know, basically birth to, I don't know, elementary school 1 week. And then the next week we do it. And some of us were kind of like, I don't know how this is going to help us. Like, how is this going to help? And it was so interesting what came out in these, you know, sessions. We didn't have someone like you to lead us through. So we were just kind of trying to figure it out. But it was just so sweet. And I think, you know, having that community, which is so hard because you have to be vulnerable. And sometimes you have to go first and be the one that says, my life is messed up right now. And then people say, me too, me too, me too. but sometimes you have to be that first person. So talk to us a little bit about how do we find that community? Because as women, I think a lot of people see it. They see the Instagram posts of like Jenny Allen and them, and they're like, oh, I wish I had that. Or they see pictures of people who are like, this is my tribe. And they're like, I don't have that. How do we have that? Because everyone wants it.
You know, Christy, this is there's probably not a more commonly asked question of me. How do I find this? And the first thing that I say is, if we are made to live in God's image, then we find it in the same way that God did. And how did God do that? Well, God didn't just show up and find it. It wasn't a prefabricated arrangement where God just joined somebody that was already there. God, in his book Genesis, the story we haven't heard, the author whose name I'm blanking on will come to me, Paul Borgman. Paul Borgman was a professor of literature, and he would teach Genesis at Gordon College. He taught Genesis as a literature course. And that course became a book called Genesis, the Story We Haven't Heard. And in this book, Borgman writes and asks this question. He said, who knows how many people God asked to go with him from Mesopotamia to Canaan before in Abraham he finally found someone who said, yes, I'll go. He said, we don't know because there's no story to be told there. But we do know that when Jesus asked certain people to follow him, they said things like, I got to go bury my dad. I've got to go check out a piece of land that I just bought. And on and on and on. We know that Jesus knows what it's like to ask people to be in community who turn him down. Yes, we've heard about Peter, James, and John. But who knows how many people Jesus asked before he asked them who said no. There's no story there because there's nobody there to tell it. And so what we see is that confessional communities, a community like this, is not something we find. It is something that we create. Somebody in your Bible study, I wonder who that was, decided they were going to take the risk and ask someone else, would you be willing to consider doing this? And there may be people that we ask who will say, I think you're wacky. Who in their right mind would do that? We will come like, well, I don't understand how this is going to be helpful. I don't have time for all that. Like, no, let's just have a Bible study. Let's just have prayer. All these things that help us remain in the abstract about life. We can talk about the Bible. We can talk about what we read. But to talk with you about you and me, that becomes the place where the Holy Spirit begins to do actual real work in real time and space. And so Jesus knows exactly how hard it is to ask and ask again and ask again for people to be with him in this journey and for some of them to say, no, I'm not going to do that.
So persevere is,
and I want,
so persevere.
Yeah. I want I want our listeners to know there's a reason why Jesus said the gate and the road is narrow. And as such, it's important to know that even when we keep asking, we are going to run into people who at some point are going to be willing to take the risk. Mm-hmm. And I will say the evidence that we have is that ultimately it is extraordinarily worth that kind of work.
Yeah, I agree. I've experienced it, and it is. I want you to put your parenting hat on for a second and talk to me about how do we help our kids suffer well? Because every parent wants to make sure their kids do not suffer. I mean, especially in this day and age, we want to get everything out of their way to make sure they don't experience any negative emotion. Mm-hmm. So how do we help our kids learn how to suffer well now so that when they're our age, they don't have to learn it?
Well, I think one of the most important things is for our parents who are listening is that it will be really difficult for us to teach our children and to walk with them into resilience if we do not have someone doing that with and for us. And so the starting place for our considering this question actually is not with our kids. Starting place is, who are the people who are enabling us as parents to suffer well? Because if we don't have that, we can't give it to our kids. So that's going to be the first priority. The next thing I think to consider is that children don't need parents to be perfect. Children do not need a world in which they do not suffer. Look, the only way we are not going to screw up our kids is just don't have them. Right. It's the only way we're not going to screw them up. Like, it's going to happen. But kids don't need parents that are perfect. Kids need parents who are attuned and who are at the ready to repair ruptures.
That's good.
That's what they really need. And my attunement does not mean that I make sure that my child cannot in any way, shape, or form cut his eye on any counter in my kitchen. Attunement means that when my child does cut his eye, I can be with him and say, oh, that's a nasty cut. Let's do something about that. Now, granted, am I going to let my two-year-old just run into the street? No. But at some point, I'm going to let my 12-year-old cross the street without me being on the porch watching him do that, or my 8 or 10-year-old, because I've done everything that we can possibly do. I'm going to let my child learn from their bumps and bruises of all the things that life will teach them, recognizing that it is not pain that wounds our children. What wounds our children is when we, in their pain, are not willing to be present with them. One of the messages that we send to our children, when we are working so diligently to make sure that they do not suffer, is we are saying to them, we do not believe that you have what it takes to grow into a fully functioning adult. That's what we're telling them. And their brains sense this. Their brains sense this. There was I don't mean to off-road too much, but this is a really, I think, really helpful piece of research information. Richard Davidson at the University of Wisconsin many years ago did a 25-year longitudinal study on parenting of shy children. And after 25 years, they followed these kids for 25 years. And at the end of that time, they did some research work on these kids after following them. And what they discovered was that these children, who are now adults, shook out into three groups. At the end, it's going to sound like Goldilocks and the Three Bears, and predictably so. The first group was a group of shy kids who, as adults, reported that they were hard driving, getting things done, working really hard, so forth and so on. If you talk to the people who worked with them, they would say, yep, they are leaders, they're hard driving, all these kinds of things, but they're also very harsh and they're not very fun to work with, even though they're getting all kinds of things done. When you saw the pattern of their parents were people who saw their kids as shy, believed that the world was going to pancake them, and so they forced their kids to do all kinds of things that were difficult. And their kids often got overwhelmed, but their parents were having them do really, really hard things without recognizing that there are times when it was too hard. But these are kids who grew up to be all these kinds of things, but not necessarily people that people love to be around in the workplace. The second group, just the opposite. Parents who saw their kids as being shy, and they did everything they could to protect their children. And these were children who grew into adults who were passive, who drove people nuts at their workplace for other reasons, because they weren't willing to take initiative. They had a hard time getting things done. The third group, not surprisingly, these were parents who, recognizing that their kids were shy, pushed their kids, but were attuned to what it would look like when their kids were becoming overwhelmed and would not push them over the threshold. But they allowed their kids to make mistakes. They allowed their kids to get bumps and bruises, but their parents were attuned and present with them. Now, what was really significant at the end of all this was that these were kids who grew up, who the surveys were that people loved to work with them. They were good leaders. They were good followers. But the first group and the second group all reported having a deep memory of having been shy and their parents having pushed them when they wished they wouldn't and having not pushed them when they wished they would. The third group had no memory of being shy.
Hmm.
And what this points to is that even though they were working with the same kinds of brains, all that would have been kids who were temperamentally shy, the parenting itself changed the outcome of the kids' experience of themselves and of the world, despite the fact that they were biologically primed to be shy.
Wow.
And what this tells us is that we as parents, if we are attuned to our kids, allowing them to struggle but not being overwhelmed by it, our problem today is that in our fear that we will be overwhelmed, we don't let them mm-hmm. struggle. Instead of being attuned enough with them so that we're watching them. What does this mean? This means I actually have to pay attention to my kid, not to my phone.
Yeah.
This is a challenging thing for us. And so the good news is that children are extraordinarily resilient. Mm-hmm. They just need to be given the opportunity to demonstrate to you and to the world that they actually have more than what it takes, probably more even than our parents think they do. They just need to be given the opportunity to do that.
Yeah.
Our attunement and our willingness to repair ruptures and our willingness to say with them, this is really hard. Let's keep trying. This is really hard. Let's keep trying. Making sure that we are not allowing shame to be part of the conversation. This is what really bridges to this next place where kids develop resilience without feeling like they have to overwork to please everybody mm-hmm. or without worrying that they're going to please nobody and therefore cave in.
That's good. And that's a fine line to balance as a parent, for sure.
It is. It is. And here's the thing, Chris, this is the thing. As a parent, I'm going to worry that I don't know where the line is. I'm going to worry, am I pushing them too hard? Am I not pushing them hard enough? I'm going to worry about these things. And this is where it becomes crucially important for me as the parent to have my own circle of people to whom I am saying, I'm worried about what I'm doing. And they say to me, we're not leaving the room. This is hard for all of us. Let's stay together. Let's see because it's not just hard for my kid. It's hard for me that it's hard for the kid.
Exactly.
And this is where I am having to struggle as my child is struggling. And in the same way that my child needs me to be in that space and say, this is hard, I see that, let's keep trying. I need others in my corner saying to me, this is really hard, let's keep trying this.
Do you feel like that parent, like the parent confessional group is harder than just, you know, a singular? Like for me, it is easier probably for me to tell my struggles than the struggles that I'm dealing with my kids. Or I notice that a lot of people, if we have a vulnerable conversation and we start talking about the struggles of our kids, it's like, oh my goodness, thank God you're dealing with that too. Or I thought I was the only one. And I don't know mm-hmm. if it's the shame as parents, like if our kids are struggling, then we must be bad parents. And so we just kind of give the Instagram version of how great they are and how wonderful they are. But I sense it a lot in parents that they just do not go deep with what is going on with their kids. And to me, that is so isolating.
Right. Well, imagine this. I mean, imagine that and anything that anybody does in their vocational life, you're a furniture maker. You're an attorney, you're a teacher, you are an artist. In any of these professions, you are putting your craft on display, as it were. And people have the option of judging that. People will say, you're a great teacher, or you're a great attorney, or I really love how you're doing this work or that work or whatever it is that you're doing. So many of those things. We are the ones, like I am the one who has the capacity to have agency over what it is that I'm doing. My work is the evidence of me. Mm. There's great continuity between me and my, you see where this is going. But when I have children, they now can walk out in the world and make me look like a doofus. Right. And then of course, and so like I just don't have agency over this. And so the capacity of my children to be an extension of me and do to me what I am terrified that they may do to me in public or whatever it is that I'm having challenges with, of course, touches extraordinarily tender parts of who we are as human beings. And the capacity and the ease with which shame wants to walk in and take over the conversation is like few other things that are true about who we are. Our children are the closest thing that there is to making us feel naked in public with us still having our clothes on. And, you know, and you're like, Jiminy Christmas, like, come on.
Right.
Please stop doing this to me. Right. And so consequently, the fact that I have so little control over that is part of how I feel so much more vulnerability and why shame is so much more powerful in that regard. And as we like to say, you know, the work that we do is work in which we name things to tame things. Mm. And the sooner that we put language to the emotional states that we have, the more integrated that is in my own mind, in my own brain. If I put words from my left brain to the feeling in my right, in the presence of another who is able to validate that, who can say, oh my gosh, me too. Yeah. I'm so glad that you said that because I'm about to kill my child and I really don't want to commit a felony today.
Right.
Right. And so that whole sense of withness, of you being with me, us being with each other in our common places of fragility. When that happens, we are creating an opportunity for us. When we are with a gathering of parents, we are creating a community that is not unlike what we read about at the end of Genesis chapter 2, where the man and his wife were naked and unashamed, right? You've got differentiated and linked parts, male and female, differentiated. They're separate, very different. Just like we are different from other parents, but they're linked, they're together, but they're naked, they're vulnerable, right? That word naked in English in Genesis chapter 2 from the Hebrew indicates not just the nakedness of their physicality, it's the nakedness of their vulnerability. They need one another to protect one another and to help one another. This is what we need. And they do so, the man and his wife were naked and unashamed. In the absence of shame is where we come to reveal these parts of our story, such that my suffering that takes place in the privacy of my own mind about my worry that my teenage son is not ever going to get off fentanyl, that my daughter is not going to be able to control her eating behavior problem, and on and on and on. Which is really just, it's not just about the worry that I have about my children. You know, one of the things that we say in our work is that anxiety for every human being, my anxiety that I have is always ultimately about me. Mm. It doesn't mean that it's only about me. I can be anxious about my children, but even my anxiety about my children is an extension of ultimately what's going to happen to me if my children are not well. What is it going to be like for me if something really goes wrong with my child? What am I going to experience? Mm. And so at first glance, it looks like I'm worried about my children's suffering when really I'm worried about me.
That's good.
And so I can't really begin to talk about my kid. This is why we say I can't give what I don't have. I can't be helpful for my child if I myself am not having an experience of being surrounded by a body of people whose job and who long to come for me and I come for them, such that we can collectively be present for our child in a non-anxious way. While at the same time not hovering, not lawnmowering, not helicoptering, right. Not any of those words, such that they learn that they can be in the world and hard things can happen. And when they do, we'll ask them, what is this like? And they're going to tell us, and we're going to say, wow, that sounds really hard. And we're not going to move to fix it. We're going to move to be with it.
Mm, that's good.
And they're going to learn by being with us, being with them, that they can be okay not being okay. And that is the heart of how suffering is redeemed. This is what Emmanuel is all about. This notion of God with us, this notion of atonement, the word atonement, the English word atonement is a combination of three old English words, at one meant. That God is so with us in our suffering that we begin to practice paying more attention to the presence of God, even if our pain is not reduced.
Yeah.
And as such, it changes the nature of how I experience my suffering, and it also enables me to realize how I am that much more deeply connected to God in the process. I've had three older brothers. When I was born, my brothers were 18, 16, and 11 years of age. My oldest brother went off to college, and a week later, I was born, and he comes home for Thanksgiving, and he asked, like, what's that? What is that? I've lost all three brothers to cancer.
Sorry.
And the first of my three brothers to die died about, I guess it was about 19 years ago now. And I remember he lived with pancreatic cancer for 3 years. And he said at the end of his life, and this is a guy whose life was transformed by his suffering, who became a bright, burning light for Jesus in ways that I never would have imagined would have happened. And I remember him saying to me as he was closing in on death, he said, I would never wish cancer on my worst enemy. And I can say at the same time that I am not sorry this has happened. Mm. Because of how his experience of it categorically changed the degree of closeness that he had with his wife, with his family, with me included, with others, with his friends. This is not to say that cancer is a good thing. There's nothing good about cancer. This is to say that the Christian vision of the world means that there's nothing so horrific that God cannot, by being in the middle of it, redeem it.
That's good. That's beautiful. Oh, I feel like we could talk for hours, but I kind of want to end on that just because I think that is, that's it. That is the thing. That is suffering, you know, to have that hope of atonement and that we are brought closer to him through it. And I used to have a bracelet. I still have the bracelet, actually. And a friend of mine gave it to me and she ended up passing away a year later. We had no idea. I mean, she had a brain aneurysm. It was a complete surprise. Mm-hmm. But so interestingly enough, about 2 weeks before she passed away, we were all together in kind of a very intimate group that we were friends with. And she said, basically, I want to be so close to Christ that no matter what happens to me or my family or anything around me, that even if, and the phrase that I have a bracelet just to remind me is even if the suffering doesn't leave, even if the pain doesn't subside, even if I will still praise God. Mm-hmm. And that was her thing. And then she passed away 2 weeks later. And it was just that reminder of when we're in the mud and the muck, and some of the people who are listening right now are in just the heaviest of space, even if we can still be hopeful. So thank you so much for being on here and reminding us of that.
You're very welcome. Chris, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining me this week and listening to my conversation with Kurt Thompson. I encourage you again to get his book. It's on our show notes. He also has a podcast that is also on our show notes. And I encourage you to find some people that you can do community with, that you can have this community where you can share what you're suffering through. There is nothing like having a group of people who have your back. It's really hard. It's really vulnerable, but I encourage you to make a list of people if you don't already and start asking. And if they say no, ask someone else. I encourage you to do it because it will truly change your life. Thanks again for being love and doing good in your families and in your community. Have a great week. Don't want